Hello and thanks once again for taking the time to download and listen to a podcast from CelticUnderground.net. I'm Harry Brady and this is podcast number 240. My head is spinning and my legs are weak. Two-step dancing, can't hear myself. As I record this, we're about to go into a period of three Dundee United games in 3 weeks. So, what better thing to do than to have a guest who knows Dundee United inside out and also, unlike many in the industry, also is appreciative and understands everything about Scottish football. Yes, Mr. Jim Spence. Till the weekend comes to town, play one more for my radio sweetheart. It is perhaps a sad indictment on the coverage of football in Scotland that Jim is a very rare breed in the Scottish media of someone who appears to be respected by most football supporters. He's obviously an avid Dundee United fan and proud to be a Dundonian in general. However, I think fans of at least 41 of the 42 clubs in Scotland have a respect for Jim and his opinions and the fact that he's patently passionate about the game in Scotland. Jim is a former law lecturer, so has not been one of the ones to fall in the liquidation myth denial world, and that did get him into a bit of trouble in a bit of a disgraceful way, in my opinion, with the BBC for having the tenacity to state the obvious, which is a company that's gone bust cannot continue to be the same company. But hey-ho, that's for another day. We've got the three Dundee United games coming up, so we decided to get Jim on, as I said earlier. So St Anthony has had a chat with Jim, and it's about to come up. Before I get on to that, just to touch on the fantastic work of the Celtic FC Foundation. If you want to know more about it, go onto the Celtic FC Foundation website. They recently had the Celtic FC Foundation dinner at Celtic Park, which raised over £70,000 for the charity. If you want to participate yourself, there's various programmes that you can raise money on behalf of the foundation, but there's also things that you can do for yourself with various fitness programmes connected to the foundation. Forthcoming events recently announced is the Ben Nevis Huddle in June, but we also have coming up the Zipwire on the 28th of March, and I think there are just a handful, maybe not even a handful of places left, one or two places left on that. And then there is the Golf Day on the 2nd of April. The Golf Day is £100 per person to participate, with teams of four at £400, as well as some guest spaces. You don't have to be able to collate a full team of four. You may be someone who plays golf with a couple of mates, but they're not able to take the time off, or they might not be wanting to come along to a Celtic event if they're Sandy from the golf club. It doesn't really matter. There are one or two other people in that position and a team can be had. If you're at all interested in the Celtic FC Foundation's Golf Day on the 2nd of April, I think Tom Boyd, Bertie Auld and other celebs will be there along with some fantastic prizes. Go to the Celtic FC Foundation website. However, that's enough from me. This is St Anthony with him, Jim Spence. Play one more for my radio sweetheart. Play one more for my radio sweetheart. Play one more for my radio sweetheart. Play one more for my radio sweetheart.
Today I'm delighted to be joined by the esteemed Scottish journalist, radio presenter and renowned Dundee United fan, Jim Spence.
So thank you very much for that warm welcome, Steve.
So the first thing we always ask, Jim, and we're going to amend it slightly for your good self, is who was your first? What was your first Dundee United game, and who would have been your first Dundee United hero?
My first Dundee United hero didn't actually stem from the first game. My first Dundee United hero was a guy actually called Jimmy Henry, who was a midfielder, who played in the side at the time when Gerry Kerr was there. And as I recall, my first United game was actually against Barcelona, one of the first times
in
Barcelona. I was only a boy, you know. I had an easy paper round, you know, so I'm actually disguised my age quite well. But Jimmy Henry wasn't a part of that team. Jimmy Henry came years later. He was a boy from the kind of Lockie area, midfielder, kind of had that kind of swaggering style about him, kind of long.
Did he go to Newcastle?
No, he actually went to he almost went to Fulham. He was signed for Fulham for £40,000, which in those days was a lot of money. When they did the medical, they discovered he had TB, and the medical, you know, the medical basically, you know, scuppered the deal. So Jimmy Henry was very much kind of a great favourite of mine, you know, in those very early days. That kind of swagger midfielder, lovely, you know, a lovely mover, a lovely hitter of the ball, a lovely passer, not particularly quick, you know, but just kind of one of these boys you always imagined yourself being in the midfield, kind of pinging passes here, there and everywhere, you know. So it was Jimmy, but I mean, that wasn't from the early days, because, you know, the early days of the, you know, when they played the Barcelonas, and I can scarcely remember it, to be honest with you. You know, you were talking about people like the Briggs and the Gillespies and people like that. It's going back a long time, and I'm sure we'll come to this, but United kind of in a sense hadn't long emerged from the shadow of Dundee, you know, because they were very much traditionally, until probably the 60s and 70s, the city's second team, you know. So that's the one that sticks uppermost in my mind. There's a few of Celtic that stick in my mind as well, you know. But Jimmy Henry was very much an early favourite. In fact, there was a great tale. The day that Celtic won, the day that Celtic lost to Partick Thistle in the League Cup final, I'd won a trip on the Dundee United team bus with a guy called Ian Nisbet. The trip was actually won by a mate of mine, Gordon Mitchell, who then couldn't go. That's another story. So he handed me a ticket. And in those days, United used to travel through Fife via Dollar and the Gap Lindsay Hotel at Pearl Mill, sadly now knocked down. So you would stop, the team would stop for lunch before they headed off. Now, we were going to Shawfield that day. There was two things stuck in the mind. They had just re-signed Ian Mitchell from Newcastle United. He'd gone to Newcastle, hadn't worked out, he came back. We went down to the Pearl Mill, you know, Gap Lindsay Hotel, stopped, had a bite of lunch, and me and the guy, Ian Nisbet, were sitting there in awe. These United players around about us having a lunch. Gerry Kerr, who was the manager, and his old sponge man, kit man, physio, was a guy called Andy Dixon. And Andy was asked to go and look for a certain player who'd gone missing from the dinner. And Andy went away to look for him. We'll mention the guy's name, but he went away to look for him, came back, and he said, "It's okay, boss, he's only had a couple." So this was a player who had a couple of nips and a couple of drinks before the game, you know. But United went on to win that day. I think they beat Clyde 1-0 that day. And as we were coming to Shawfield, buses full of ecstatic Partick Thistle fans were, you know, these old buses that you had a platform and were whipping round, you know, on their way back up to Maryhill. And we couldn't believe it as the score came through that day, you know. Thistle had beaten Celtic 4-1, you know, some great players on the Thistle side, some great players on the Celtic side, obviously, but you know, Ian Mitchell had re-signed that day. That always kind of stuck in my mind, you know, as one of my earliest trips to Glasgow on the United team bus, you know. That was a great day.
The Dundee rivalry, you know, you've got two clubs who basically are on the same street. There's a friend of mine who's a Man City fan. I remember taking to a game at Dens Park, and he was gobsmacked that you could actually have two football stadiums, big football stadiums, in the one street. It's an amazing thing. You hear about it, but until you actually see it, it's hard to describe, you know. So
yeah, I mean, it is. I mean, I think they're either the two closest in Europe, or they're almost. I mean, I think there's maybe one in one of the old Eastern Bloc countries that's a wee bit closer, but I mean, you're right. I mean, there's 100 metres or 100 yards in Old Parlance between the two, and you could kick a ball quite easily, you know, from the perimeters of Dens to Tannadice. It's almost impossible to say what drives you into one camp or t'other. I mean, when I was at school, I went to a school, Lossier Academy in Dundee, and it was, you know, primarily Dundee fans in my class, you know, in the kind of, you know, the 60s, primarily Dundee fans. Being a Catholic school, it was a big Celtic support. And there was hardly any of us who were United fans in the class. There was maybe three or four of us who were United fans. United were very much the underdogs. But there was also quite a big tradition of people crossing the divide, if you want. We could put them in. My late father was one. He would go and watch Dundee for kind of quality and craft, as he put it, and United for blood and snotters, because, you know, United had come through the old B division in the 50s and into the early 60s, you know, when Jerry Kerr finally won them promotion, and it's, you know, 57, 58 season, 58, 59, when they came up in a game against Berwick Rangers, you know. So there was a big tradition of people crossing the divide, you know. You know, you go watch Dundee one week, and you go watch United the next, and very much Dundee were the bigger supporter of the two clubs, probably by a substantial way. But United were always able to get decent crowds, but there was no geographical factor, despite, you know, the fact that United had been set up as Dundee or Burnley.
And I was about to say that, would there not have been a sort of the Catholic enclave in Dundee, no, well, seen a sort of loyalty to Dundee United?
Strangely, there might have been remnants of it, but I mean, when I think back, there were you know, lots of guys, as I say, when I went to a Catholic, one of Dundee's Catholic secondaries at that time, and there was, you know, there were loads of the guys who were all Dundee fans, you know. I mean, religion by and large has never played a part in either of two clubs. I mean, United were Dundee Hibernian for you know, for a period, a very short period, until the founding father and others part really decided to broach it to a wider a wider kind of audience. They would change the name to Dundee United, you know. But there was never, there's no any history of kind of any sectarian element by either of two clubs in terms of signing policy or support or any of the rest of it. I mean, I suspect that, you know, over a period of time, United replaced Dundee as the bigger of the two clubs, bigger support than the rest of it, simply by dint of their success and Dundee's kind of failure to build on the kind of the great years in probably the late 50s and early 60s when they won the league and went to the semi-final European Cup. You know, I mean, I think, you know, we were doing some stuff recently on crowds, and I think it was 48-49 season, which was post-war. It was a boom period for all Scottish clubs. Dundee's average crowd was something like 24,500, you know, and that would have been a period, I think Celtic at that time, round about 32, 33, something like that, you know. Maybe it was a bit more than that. Rangers were about 42. So, you know, all the city clubs were very well supported at that time, you know. But Dundee never kind of, never really grasped, you know, the big crowds and the money they brought in from the sale of people like Gilzean and Ewer and Cook and these sort of guys, and never built on that success. So over a long period of time, their fortunes dipped and United went up, you know, and United probably captured a generation or two. Plus, of course, there was always the areas around about Dundee. I mean, Dundee's a city then, had a population of give or take 200,000. But there were areas in kind of Angus and Perthshire and across in Fife which were traditionally kind of supportive of Dundee. United probably tapped into that market as well. You know, people from Montrose and Forfar and Brechin and Blairgowrie and these sort of areas, you know. So it's really difficult to put a finger on why, because there are families I know that are split right down the middle. There's brother who's a United fan, brother who's a Dundee fan. I mean, I remember Radio 5 coming up years back, and I took him to my kind of local bar, which is Frew's Bar in Dundee, which is a great United bar, but none of the guys could put their fingers on why, you know, they supported United and other guys supported Dundee, you know, and there were lots of split loyalties. So there's no kind of geographical, there's no political, there's no kind of religious divide to it. It's a very strange thing. One Dundee supporter did say to me the other day that their support now tends to fall into the kind of like the over 50s and 60s or very young kids coming up. There's a big gap in between, and there might be something in that. The United, through the glory years, if you want, European years, have captured that big tranche, you know. But and putting your finger on what separates the clubs, almost impossible. I kind of do it, you know.
Well, the two stadiums, you know, you've got Dens Park and you've got Tannadice. I mean, I can recall being in Dens when it was 25,000, and I can remember being in Tannadice when it was 22,000, and it was wonderful atmospheres.
There were great atmospheres. I'm trying to, you know, you'll be able to tell me which game you were at Dens, but one of the games I can recall at Dens, funnily enough, because I mean, very often, you know, if I wasn't away to see United, I went week a bit as well. I'll come to it, I mean, in terms of how I got to support United, because I had quite a strange upbringing in football. You know, it was quite quite universal in terms of kind of the games I went to see. But I was at a game when Celtic destroyed a very good Dundee side 8-1, you know. I think that day there must have been 26 or 27,000 in Dens. I remember a League Cup replay. Dundee had played, here's me as a United fan talking about Dundee, but they played Hibs on the Saturday in front of, I think, 28,000 at Easter Road. It had been 3-3 and they'd gone to Dens on Tuesday night, and it was 33,000 there, you know. Now, that's not the greatest, you know, that's no kind of tucked away a century ago, you know, that's in kind of fairly short-lived memory that crowds like that were attracted. But Tannadice traditionally for the big European nights would attract anywhere from kind of 18, 19, 20, right up to 28,000 against Barcelona. Mm-hmm. And United, being a ground which is right on top, as you well know, right on top of the pitch, there's always a great atmosphere. Dens was always that bit further away, you know.
The Tannadice legend was always the steepness of the terrace and steps, especially in that enclosure, because they were quite tall, but they were narrow, and it meant when you scored the goal, it was always a big swing.
It was a big terrace, and I mean, I'm not entirely sure what it held entirely in its entirety, but given that, you know, the capacity of the ground was 28,000, it very probably took about 10 or 12,000 at the terrace, you know. I mean, it was a very, very steep terrace, and there was usually a great atmosphere for a big game. It would sway. Funnily enough, I was just sitting looking at a picture last night before it was, you know, before, I mean, it eventually became, I think, unofficially the Raymond Stewart enclosure.
United fought Ray Stewart
for 400,000 at West Ham. Wee Jim McLean probably spent 100,000, mm-hmm, putting that.
We had a discussion on one of the Celtic websites. People are trying to work out exactly when that went up, which is part of the reason why I think that came to discussion. Aye. And you said, well, it must have been 79, because when Stewart went down to West Ham, then they threw up the shed.
They spent £100,000 for it. I mean, if you're in the old main stand at Tardis, which is mildly been done up, away to your left, you've got a traditional shed, which is where I stood as a boy. You know, but the big main terrace and that became kind of unofficial, as I say, the Ray Stewart end. And that was bought and paid for by the Raymond Stewart money, by about 100,000 of it. But I saw a picture just the other night, in fact, of a Celtic United game. The gap in the middle where, you know, at that time, that was just actually the start of segregation. Because at one time, you know, you remember quite well, we went and stayed. My old man would tell me regularly about going to games. My mother's second cousin was a fellow called Jim Brady, who was a professional boxer. In fact, he fought Benny Lynch three times. I think he drew once and lost twice with Lynch. In the days when, you know, there's a big pro boxing circuit in Scotland and Dundee also, and the old man would go with, you know, Jim Brady to games at Dens and Tannadice and all the rest of it, and the guys all stood, you know, they all mixed. They'd be starting with a squad of boys who travelled through on the break, as they called it in these days, you know, from Glasgow or whatever. So, you know, but there was this great picture, and you could see there was a throng of Celtic supporters, a huge throng, and it kind of reminded me very much of the days when Celtic or Rangers would come to Tannadice and Dens, and they'd bring 10,000 with them quite easily, you know, they'd bring huge supports with them, you know.
I'm kind of torn about that. I know that
Celtic, I'm not sure, like, speaking of turn, I'm likely to believe Celtic had meetings just the other week, presumably the council, not down here. I know United are pursuing it, some kind of safe standing areas, and I'm in favour. I'd quite like that, you know. I'd quite like to see, I mean, I think I was down for the game the other week, Celtic in at Milan, and irrespective of what anybody thinks of the Green Brigade, what they do is they lend a great atmosphere, I think, to Celtic Park, you know. So I'm quite keen on the return, certainly some safe standing of football. But no, I mean, going back to Tannadice and Dens, I suppose, like many of the old stadiums in Scotland, had a great atmosphere. I would say Tannadice had the better of the atmospheres because it was so tight and compact, and all the rest of it, you know. And by and large, you know, on the great European nights, and against, particularly against Celtic Rangers, it was usually chock-a-block, you know. There was always a fantastic atmosphere, you know.
It was always a great place to go to. The, in terms of, you were talking there about the Dundee being a prominent team at one point. Certainly when I was a wee boy, in my youngest days, Dundee were a team, Gordon Wallace and John Duncan, Jockey Scott, a fantastic team. And I can trace it back to 1976, because I don't think people appreciate when the, you and I are old enough to remember the old First Division when it was 18
clubs.
Sadly,
that's right, yeah.
Right, you know, if you finished ninth in the First Division, then that would be deemed as an average season.
Yeah,
you know,
right,
I mean, you're mid-table, right, right, mid-table. But when it became the Premier League and the Scottish Premier League, and you finished ninth in a 10-team league, you were relegated. And I think what people don't appreciate is that first season, 75-76, Aberdeen, Dundee United and Dundee all finished level on points.
That's right.
And often feel sorry for Dundee from the point of view that they never recover from getting relegated. They only get relegated by something like four goals.
You're absolutely right. In fact, it's, if there's one key feature of, you know, I mean, I talked earlier on about, you know, how United overtook Dundee and all the rest of it, but for, you know, even through the 60s, when Gerry Kerr eventually gave way to Jim McLean, who'd come across from Dens to coach at Tannadice, then becoming a manager, even through that period, you know, it was still very much a match. United were only kind of starting to cling on to their coattails and start to kind of build a bigger support, a regular support, and all the rest of it. Dundee were still very much a prominent side, you know, they were very much the establishment side. in the city. But what really killed them, and what I think they've never recovered from, they've never really endured stability after that period where they went down.
They're a yo-yo team.
Yeah. They've become a yo-yo team. Mm-hmm. They've never really recovered that.
And yet they're arguably the fifth or sixth biggest team in the country.
Yes, well,
in terms of resources, support, stadium.
Undoubtedly. Craig Levine once said to me that he thought that, you're Glasgow kind of first, but Dundee was a bigger football city than either Edinburgh or Aberdeen, and I actually suspect that if you took the home core support of the two cities, I mean, at the moment United play a home core anywhere between 6,000 and 6,500. Now that's for a bulk standard game, no disrespect to a Partick or a Motherwell, but there's no big travelling support. Dundee are playing 5, maybe 5,500. So there's a home core about 11,000, and there's no crossover these days. That's gone. So realistically, for a city which is now smaller than Aberdeen, because as Dundee depopulated like Glasgow, deindustrialised, Aberdeen went into the overdrive, population wise and oil boom wise. The two city clubs, jointly, actually probably draw a bigger crowd than Aberdeen have been doing until late, and they probably draw as much, if not outdraw, the current Hibs side, So you then kind of split it down the middle, and Dundee are still playing to 5,500, 6,000. You've got Celtic, Rangers, Hibs, Hearts, Aberdeen, then United, and then Dundee. So the sixth or seventh biggest supporting club in the country.
And the other thing as well is that these days we're talking about TV deals and all the rest of this stuff, the Dundee derby is always a rip-roaring affair. And even this season, there's been a couple that have been absolute crackers. And in fact, I couldn't understand, I don't want to be critical because we're in the BBC, but there was a Dundee derby in a cup earlier in the season and they chose something bad for itself.
Well, we have these debates internally as well, and never mind the debates internally. Dundee and United fans would be, screeching, they'd be crying out loud for that, I think, much as Mo O'Brien came for Denison, I would have to say that sometimes, the BBC in Glasgow and Glasgow can be a fairly parochial affair, You can sometimes tend to think that anything that happens beyond Huginfield Lock, and it's still there, isn't actually that important, So I know, and these are great games. I mean, what I would say this season is they have been the second one, certainly, because Paul Hartley's actually done a very good job at Dens. The second one was much more competitive than the first one. United kind of blew Dundee off the park, but I mean, it's some great Dundee derbies over the years, And again, crowd wise, at the moment they're all sellouts, But in the kind of halcyon days when the stadiums were bigger, it was well into the 20, late 20,000s, in terms of crowds, So it was always a terrific atmosphere. And for many years, just as we talked earlier on as well, you went to the game and you mixed as well. Mm-hmm. Once segregation came in, that was different. But one of the great things, you always get your dafties as you get anywhere, but by and large, guys will go to the pub, have a couple of beers, go and then go their separate ways and meet up again in the boozer after. Guys at United, Dundee, men, or Blue Noses and Adams, as they'd be called in Dundee, that's one of the great. It is a, without overdoing it, without being schmaltzy, but it is a pretty friendly rivalry. Yeah. That's not to say that you do not want to win, there's nothing worse if you're an Arab than a Doon from the Blue Noses or vice versa on Derby Day, But there's a great deal of kidology and a great deal of fun.
It's a pity Dundee couldn't have. I know it was a house of cards and it came crashing down. You see the time that Bonetti was there and did. Caballero, Nemzadze, Caniggia, they were a smashing team to watch. And some of the Dundee derbies at that period were fantastic. The BBC had the contract at the time to show the live games, and I used to watch them regularly, and they were terrific affairs.
They did have a fantastic side at that time. And funnily enough, on my way down here today, I was chewing the fat with Peter Marr, who owned the club at that time. And Peter's a great Dundee fan, I think the day that Caniggia made his debut for Dundee was at Aberdeen. And it was a day, sadly, that Jim McLean,
John Barnes.
Launched an attack on my colleague John Barnes, because bizarrely I would usually have been at Tannadice that day, I was sent up to Pittodrie, and I took my young lad, who's now 23, but at that time I think he was either just on the verge of or had signed, because he went right through the youth ranks at Dens. He was a goalkeeper, took his sight off me sadly, so hence the reason he did turn pro, but he went right through the Dens youth ranks from I think primary 6 right through to being Barry Smith's 19s keeper for a couple of years. But I went up that day and Caniggia made his debut. Dundee won, as I recall, I think it was 2-0 at Pittodrie. And they had some fabulous players. We used to go and watch them training at Caird Park, which is where Liz Lynch or Liz McCaughan, as she is nowadays, did our training at the Caird Park Stadium. and Dundee trained at the other, but there's a velodrome in Dundee, and they would train there. And you'd watch these guys in training, like Caballero and Amazazzi, and there was a period as well, they were signing boys like Ravinelli, you know. It was absolutely incredible.
That's when it got ridiculous, because when they signed Ravinelli and Craig Burley roughly the same day.
Well, Burley thinks I'm a hex, because he's never been paid since I interviewed him, you know. Geez, £8,000 a week, and never saw it.
Well, the point I was about to make is, even guys like myself began to think, you know, how can they sustain that, you know?
Well, there was a couple of things. I mean, it's funny you say it, because there's a seminal moment in every period of life, isn't there? I remember, you know, one of the great things about the Dundee Derby is usually traditionally United will have maybe a light lunch at Tannadice or sandwich or something, and then walk up, and vice versa. Dundee players will do the same, meet at Dens, walk down, you know. And the Dundee players are walking down that day. It was a derby, and it was a Sunday game, and I was interviewing Ravinelli, and there were hundreds of kids all round about me, you know. It was like the Pied Piper. They weren't there to see me, they were there to see Ravinelli. And I just had that kind of mental flash, and I thought, this is unsustainable. Mm-hmm. Dundee Football Club, I mean, this wasn't the Dundee of the 50s that could attract 25,000 average. Even by then, even with these great players, they were getting kind of averages about 7, maybe 8,000. Mm-hmm. So you sensed that it would have either taken them years of success with these kind of players to get the crowds back, or more likely, as it happened, those great days of the big crowds had gone, and it was unsustainable. And it was unsustainable. I mean, the kind of money they were paying these boys was just unsustainable. Of course, not that long after it, the whole shooting match went.
They're lucky they survived it because it was very lucky. Touch and go at one point with Dundee.
It was pretty desperate, actually. I mean, I can remember, you know, I mean, I know the journalists get the name of being hard hearted swines, you know, but I mean, I can remember being outside Dens Park, and, you know, bear in mind, you've got your family history tied up. I've got mates that are Dundee fans. My old man probably sympathised more with Dundee than he did United, you know. Because, you know, of his generation, they were the bigger club, and United had always kind of run on a tight shoestring budget anyway. But Dundee had been the establishment club, you know. And, I mean, I think I read somewhere recently between 59 and 63, they'd taken in the equivalent nowadays of £4.5 million in transfer fees.
Gilzean, Ewart, Charlie, Penman, these guys,
you know. So they brought in a lot of money, and they were still very well supported. I mean, it was quite intriguing. I mean, I've been doing a wee bit of stuff on crowd research recently, and I was taking it in tranches, 10-year periods. 64-65 season, Dundee's average crowds were still in excess of 12,000. United were actually 9. Aberdeen were only 8,300. Greenock Morton were 9,300. Because at that, you know, that spell, Morton were going for the league, you know, the rest of it. And so Dundee were still very well supported. I mean, a neighbour, my old mum, old Pearl, she was a waitress in the days of the big city. You know, you'd the same in Glasgow, you'd the big city department stores, and we had 3 or 4 in Dundee, and all had their wee restaurants, you know. And Pearl was the waitress, I think it was in Draffins. And every day, the Dundee players, after training, would go down with their, you know, their grey flannels, their club blazer, their shirt and tie, the crest, and they would have a 3-course lunch. I mean, they were very much seen as being the establishment club, big club, you know, did things the proper way and all the rest of it. And within a period of, what, 10, 12 years, they've been in administration twice and were hanging on. I mean, they've now got new owners, obviously, but were hanging on. United, who traditionally, you know, from the early days of Dundee Hibs through Park Riley to the early days of Dundee United, who'd kind of fluttered a couple of times with disaster, poor relation, you know, very much not the establishment club, had built a relatively solid base, you know, had established a great youth system under Wee Jim McLean, exciting players, you know, managed the trick of selling a terrific player every couple of years, and Andy Greer would go for bring the money in.
Bob Crampsey once said that there was a discussion about Dundee merging, the two clubs merging, and his argument, that I think quite rightly, is you can either have two teams in Dundee and you don't have any,
because there's no evidence
whatsoever to suggest that there's any great desire to. I think there was a thing for ground sharing maybe at one point if they could have found a greenfield site to build something on. But Crampsey also said something. He said that the 61-62 Dundee team was the best team that he'd ever seen.
He said, you know what?
He's seen a fair amount of
football. It's an interesting you say that, because I emceed Davy Bowman's testimonial dinner in the Angus Hotel in Dundee, no longer there. It's the site of a new big shopping centre. And the speakers that night were Bob Crampsey, Frank Carson spoke, and I think, as I recall, David Miller spoke, you know. It was a great night, it was a very good night. But Crampsey stood up that night in a hall of 400 United fans and said that Dundee had been the finest all-time classical Scottish side he'd ever seen, and actually got a round of applause for it, you know. And I mean, You know, I have to say, I can't remember them, but the old man talked in glowing terms about them, you know. And in fact, just a few years back, we went to the funeral of the skipper, the late skipper, Bobby Cox, who was one of the stars of that side. You know, Bobby's a local boy, you know, St. Peter and Paul's, up to St. John's High School, you know, very much a local guy, born kind of yards for Dens Park, you know. And, you know, there's no doubt at that time that they were seen very much as a class act. I mean, some of the results in Europe, which actually United then went on to replicate, but I mean, some of the results in Europe in the season they went to the semi-final European Cup, beating Cologne 8-0 and things like that, were just, you know, were quite astounding. But from there on, you know, it was pretty much downhill all the way. Not in an over the cliff sort of way,
but there was a steady gradual decline and descent,
you know.
So we can't talk about Dundee United without mentioning Jim McLean. And of course, the great irony is he was an ex-Dundee player, and I believe he was a Dundee coach at the time that he got poached to Tannery.
Well, he was, and I mean, intriguingly, McLean, the general feeling at Dens Park was that McLean was the next Dundee manager waiting, but they didn't give him the job. You know, they appointed John Prentice, and McLean. You know, McLean was apparently on a real stop, a real huff about that, and you could imagine why, you know. And United made their move. I think it was Johnson Grant, you know, George Fox at the time, made their move, brought McLean across as a new coach, and it was very interesting, this, because, you know, I kind of jumped forward a wee bit, but I was at a function a number of weeks back in Dundee. It was a Hall of Fame dinner. Christian Daly was up. And a lot of people down here think Christian Daly Rangers. We never do. We just think that was a bit part for Christian, you know.
Well, he was late on in his career when he ended up there.
Very much. You know, I mean, he was a United man, you know, through and through. And in fact, he hung off when he went to Derby. He could have gone free, but he hung on. He made sure that United got a fee, because his late father, Dan Daly, and Jim McLean were great buddies, you know. Dan did a bit of scouting and that for the club. But Christian said that when he went to Derby, I think it was Steve McLaren at the time as a manager, and he thought, well, I'm going down to England, I'll learn this, I'll learn that. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. It's every day of the week, the coaching staff, McLaren come over, what did Jim McLean do here, what did he do here? He says, we were miles ahead in sports science, sports coaching, fitness coaching. He says, we were miles ahead of what was going on down there. Mm-hmm. You know, so, and McLean was, I mean, there were some great tales. So you never know what half of these are apocryphal, but it was a great tale. I mean, he used to bring in Harry Bennett, who was Liz McColgan's coach, you know, for doing things. He brought Stuart Hogan for sprint coaching, you know, years and years ago. This is before most people had ever thought about it. And there was apparently a stage where Harry Bennett, you know, the athletics coach, had said, you maybe want to think about sending your goalies to Bali. Bali training maybe once a week or something, and that was a step too far for Jim, but he was very, very far advanced. I mean, you talk to guys like Sturrock and Neary and people like that now, Davey Bowman, Jim McAnally. I mean, there's a lot of guys that, you know, that as a human being, never know mad about him. As a sports coach,
he always put me in mind Scott Spears and a Brian Clough. It was guys who would die for him in the park, but off the park,
right.
You know,
no,
there's a wee bit more resonant.
He lacked it. You know, I mean, there were great tales of him. I mean, he had spies everywhere. He would be phoning players, you know, at 10 o'clock or 11 o'clock on a Friday night just to make sure they were in bed and they weren't out. If there was a player out in a nightclub or in a pub, he knew about it the next day. We used to play, there was a wee guy you may remember played with Dundee United, Graham Payne.
Mm-hmm.
He was a wonderful wee player. And
Payne was probably the one that got away in terms of...
He was in the World Cup 40 to go, I think it was Argentina. 78, mm-hmm. Never made the final cut, you know. But we, Payne, I mean, I went to St Columbus Primary in Kirton. Where the scheme I was brought up was three. There was Westmarts, Gilburn, and there was us, St Columbus. The big rivalry was St Columbus and Gilburn. Payne always played in the primary. He always played for when he was in primary six for the school team, which in these days, when there were many better players, you could argue, or more players, was quite a feat, you know. And in later years, we used to play at the back of Kirton High School with Payne on a Sunday. There was a score of guys who'd come in and we'd play football. And every now and again, we'd have to go into a huddle because he thought he'd spotted Jim McLean's car driving down the road, you know, because that was what he did. I mean, Payne, remember, you know, when maybe we'd starting against the Celtic on a Saturday at Parkhead, and the next day he's playing with his mates at the back of Kirton High, we'd have to go into a huddle to hide the wee man just in case we'd Jim, because that was what he did. He was out and about, he checked everything. And I mean, he was a grafter. He worked 18 hour days. He'd be at every public park in Dundee, he'd be at a game at Riverside in the morning, be at Fairmuir Park in the afternoon, down at the scouting for talent, you know.
I'll tell you a couple of Celtic related stories about McLean. I went in a bus for Govan, and we used to leave at ungodly hours in the morning to get to Dundee in time for the pubs open, but we always went to the Dundee Social Club.
I don't know what street it is.
There was two reasons for that. Number one, it was a great wee club, and they made us welcome, and the second one was that you could park the bus there and you didn't need to park in Gussie Park and get caught up with, I don't know, 50 buses and be the 49th one out. And one day we were at a traffic lights, and there was a guy running by in a tracksuit with a sort of woolly hat on, and one of the boys says, "That's Jim McLean." And he stopped at the lights waiting for the traffic to go, and I'm like, "Can he be? This is maybe about 10 in the morning." And seriously, Jim McLean. So we watched our chap to Mondays, and he looked up and sure enough, it was Jim McLean. So we waved at him, if you get my drift, and he gave us a wave back, right? And everybody burst out laughing because it was wild to think that in a couple of years' time, his team were going to take place. Right. But it showed you how disciplined he was in terms of keeping himself fit.
Well, he very much was. In fact, for years, Jim played in a five-a-side team in Dundee, and kind of like just an informal five-a-side league. And he played with Walter Smith. I think Jockey Scott used to play. I think Gordon Wallace played at that stage as well. And there was a couple of others, you know, came and went and made the numbers up. And they went about 12 years unbeaten, you know. They were never ever beaten, you know. They were all very good. Obviously, they'd been top flight pros in their days, you know. And they used to play in the gym at, I went on to teach at Dundee College of Further Education, and they taught at the Kingsbury campus section that in the gym, where actually quite a lot of the players in later years taught a wee bit of PE, you know. I don't think they were actually ever qualified PE, but they took five sides in that, you know. Guys like Kenny Cameron and all the rest of it. So, wee Jim did that, I mean, he kept himself fit, you know, right through a great many years. He was a very good, very keen golfer as well. But I mean, he's a workaholic, and to be honest with you, I mean, there's three men I think that are crucial to the history of Dundee United. Pat Riley, who, the founding father, who was, you know, he was honoured the other week in the Hall of Fame dinner. He set up Dundee Hibernian. Without him, you know, there would have been no Dundee United. You know, Gerry Kerr in the 60s, I sometimes feel Gerry was kind of, what Gerry did was underrated.
Well, Gerry's idea for the tangerine slip for a start, which is synonymous with Dundee United.
That's right. Gerry took the team on tour in the 60s to America, and they played, I think they played under the, it was either Houston or Dallas, I think it was Dallas Tornadoes or something like that. Played in tangerine. Gerry liked the cut of the jib, you know. Came back, decided we'd go to it, so we ditched the old black and white or the old white strip and we went to that. Gerry was kind of very, very, you know, very far-sighted. He was bringing in guys like Orion Pearson, Leonard Wing, Mogensberg, you know, the Scandinavian thing. Probably at the time that Morton were doing the same, you know. And you sensed the end of United were starting to be on the cusp of a wave. And that was when some of the great games in Europe came, the early games against Juventus and Barcelona and things like that. And then, you know, when they put him up to general manager when Wee Jim came in, but these things never work out, you know. Quite quickly, he left the club. And Wee Jim took over general factotum because he was, you know, he was a Duce. He was, you know, he ran the show, and he had a board like Johnson Grant, George Fox, who backed him to the hilt as well. But he was, you know, I mean, he is the man effectively that really gave birth to the modern day Dundee United. I mean, the coaching methods were second to none. Scouting was fantastic as well. I mean,
it was fantastic, phenomenal.
I mean, people talk now about Dundee United youth system as something new, but Wee Jim set that up because it was only Wee United could compete.
And it always started for a few years, didn't it?
Oh, well, it went for a wee while. And in fairness, Levine kind of rekindled that when Levine came in, you know, and brought in Ian Cathro, you know, who's now over at Valencia, you know. So we always got great players, particularly from down in this area. You know, the Duncan Fergusons, Andy Gray was the first. He was the first big star, Drum Chapel boy, you know. I mean, I can actually remember, I think I was 24 at the time, and I just got married. We lived in a wee flat in the Dens Road, a wee basement flat in the Dens Road, and I got up to go to Neville Sharma, who was a local kind of news agent, and I got up and I walked around the corner and I saw the billboard, Gray sold for 100,000, 24-year-old, I burst into tears, you know. I couldn't bear it, you know, Andy was going away to Villa. I mean, we didn't get long out of him, but by God, what a player he was, you know. I mean, I know later life he had his problems with it, but what a
player. The other thing I would say about Jim McLean is as well, I always remember that when I think about Dundee United, I think of that Adidas strip that they had in the 70s. And see when it came out, I mean, the Rangers strip at the time looked so old-fashioned. It showed you that Dundee United were forward-thinking, they were modern, and this is the way teams were going to go. The hoops has always been, you probably argue that ours was old-fashioned, but it didn't look too bad because it was hoops. But there was teams at the time like Hearts and Rangers, their strips looked really dull. All of a sudden, United's got this tangerine in black, it's Adidas, it's got a three, it looked for all the time for the Holland strip that Cruyff played in. And we were all dead impressed with that.
There's something else, you know, and I suspect that even as United fans, lots of us forgive. There was another seminal moment with United, and I'm trying to remember the guy's name that set it up. In the 60s, United had a thing called Tay Pools.
Yes.
Nowadays, I mean, lottery tickets and pools things are second nature.
Used to advertise it in the programme.
It was a massive seller. I think Rangers eventually bought the idea or bought the patent on it or something like that. But United, that was what set United on the road to financial stability. That Tay Pools became a huge earner for the club in relative terms, you know, and brought in a lot of money. And that set United on the road to being able to compete, you know, with other bigger clubs in Scotland, you know. So the Tay Pools thing was a phenomenal thing for United to do, and it gave them that degree of financial stability, because really, until Eddie Thompson took, I mean, United had sailed close to the wind in previous years, but by and large under the McLean years and all the rest of it, until he started to struggle, United had always been seen as being very much a prudent financial club who sold a player every couple of years, you know, a McKinley, a Ferguson, a Christian Daly, a Goff, whatever, you know. They'd always been pretty much nailed down, you know, in terms of their finances. It was a different story when Jim eventually was forced at the door and Eddie Thompson came in, but then they were, I think it was about £4.2 million of debt, and that's over 12 years ago, so then they were struggling, but by and large, they were always financially sound, and Tay Pools had a huge amount to do in that, you know.
The other story I was going to say there about wee Jim was, it was 1993. And the papers made a big thing about it. This was his last game against Celtic before he retired. So they played Celtic at Tannadice. It was a smashing game. It was 3-2 for Celtic. Ferguson was beginning to, he was at his peak at that point. That, you know, he scored a couple of goals, I think, for United.
Ian Ferguson.
Duncan.
That was roughly
the summer that he got his transfer to Rangers. But what I remember is I was in, as you say, the old-fashioned main stand at Tannadice, and it's a long walk for the dugouts to the dressing rooms. So you're walking right along a track, and it's been many a long walk a Celtic manager said if you've got a doing it to anyway. But anyway, we Jim's walking along there, and as I said, it was well publicised in the papers and in the media that this was Jim's last game. And as he was walking along, it was noticeable he got a standing ovation, an impromptu thing. Just people stood up and started to clap, and it was obvious they were clapping for him. And he looked a bit, it was quite funny to see, because he looked kind of, they clapped for me, he looked a wee bit embarrassed. But as he looked up, and people were sort of like, it got louder and louder. And he gave a wave and he got a cheer, and there was never any love lost between Jim McLean and Celtic fans. But it goes to show how that there was a grudging admiration what the man had achieved. It was a nice moment.
I think that's right, and by and large, I think what you would always have to say is that ultimately, I think, you know, most people would regard Celtic fans by and large as being a wee bit like Liverpool. They know kind of almost timiously, if you like, excuse that expression, when somebody deserves, you know, adulation, applause, or just general kind of recognition, you know. And there is no doubt he was a unique force in Scottish football at a time when United and Aberdeen emerged to become, you know, the new firm as it was dubbed. And at a time also when Rangers weren't a force in the land.
No.
Rangers were, I mean, some dreadful Rangers sides in those days. And it was very much usually a battle between United, the Dons, and Celtic, you know, and some fabulous games between them, you know. I mean, there are, you know, countless games between United and Celtic. I mean, you mentioned big Duncan Ferguson there. I mean, and Duncan was testimony to how shrewd wee Jim was. I mean, you know, the bidding for Duncan Ferguson started off at about £2 million quid, theoretically.
Before you knew
where you were, he'd taken about £4.2 million out of David Murray's purse, or whoever's purse.
That says more about David Murray's megalomaniac personality.
Well, exactly. And United, I mean, to be honest with you, as United fans, we were sitting back watching this. I mean, this was before I was involved in broadcasting. Mm-hmm. We were watching this being played out in, you know, on the Record and the Sun, the Dundee Courier and all the rest of it, and couldn't believe it. Mm-hmm. And the bidding went up and up and up and up, and eventually, you know, Arabs were just looking at each other thinking, what's going on here? £4 million, it was an incredible amount of money in these days for United.
And he was a good player, Ferguson, but I don't think, with all due respect,
wasn't a £4 million player.
Paul Sturrock, not even there in the
That's right. I mean, he wasn't a Sturrock, he wasn't in the area, he wasn't a Bannon, you know. It was quite incredible, and that was wee Jim, because wee Jim knew how to deal with Murray. He knew Murray wanted him. He knew that Murray wasn't going to be bested by a team in England, and United did brilliantly with that, you know.
There's
my two editors. Are you coming over for a word? You'd think they were actually Celtic fans with their names, but they're only one of them. One's a Kilmarnock fan. Don't jump.
The I wrote a book recently about Celtic winning the league in 1979, aye, which is for Celtic fans is a fantastic part of our history. But the thing that I portrayed in the book, and a lot of people were surprised by this, is United blew it that year. 79 I think the three games left, and they lost to Rangers at Tannadice, they lost to Celtic at Parkhead, and they drew at Aberdeen, and maybe another two or three points would have got you the title that year.
Here's an intriguing thing, I suspect, that a lot of United fans, as they would argue that United up against Aberdeen, and United were the better team, the classier team, man for man. I mean, I'd leave other people to make that decision. It's a very tough decision, but what a lot of people think is that Ferguson, when push came to shove, Alec Ferguson had a tougher mentality and was more positive than we, Jim. And it quite often United went into games, particularly finals. I mean, you know, it's no wonder the United fanzine became known as the final hurdle, because we fell at so many of them. That very often the big mentality was missing. We, Jim, didn't set the team up properly. I'm not talking about tactically now, is that? But just the mentality, you know. I can remember a well-known referee saying to me that very often he'd refereed games that United should have won, but they didn't win. And he thought that was done.
Well, it's funny you mention that, because I've actually got that down here. And what I was going to say is that if you lose to Celtic or Rangers at Hampden with a big advantage that they've got with supports, it's not necessarily a disgrace. But I remember watching the finals against St Mirren and Motherwell, and I remember thinking, why are they struggling here? They should be running a mop with these teams.
Well, I mean, you know,
they were painful.
You know, the one against Motherwell 4-3, commonly regarded by many people as one of the best finals ever. And Motherwell had a fine side. United had a better side, you know. And against St Mirren, I would say United had a better side as well. And they should have won both, but they didn't.
You maybe make allowances for 87 because you got to the final against Gothenburg, which probably took away some of the shine for the Scottish Cup final. But even then, it was pretty grim.
I mean, I think, by and large, there's a general feeling that we lacked that big kind of game mentality. Jim was maybe just sometimes overly negative in terms of how he set the players out. You know, you watch him, you watch him, instead of this guy will be worrying about you. Because, I mean, realistically, when you look at some of the players that United had, they were good enough to and they regularly did, they were good enough to take on the best in Europe, and did, you know. So quite often they fell.
He never won a final at Hampden, did he?
No,
it was really odd, because he was about 6 or 7 finals.
Bizarrely, I was on the the day that they finally won the Scottish Cup. It was with Ivan Golak, and we'd made requests to Rangers and to Dundee United to have a reporter on the two buses live. Rangers didn't buy it. Golak, who loved all that sort of stuff, agreed to it. So I was the reporter on the bus. And we were doing live inserts, but, you know, joined the team hotel and wend our way through Glasgow. And it was a great day for United fans, but on the bus, the atmosphere of positivity was unbelievable. Absolutely unbelievable. Golak had them whipped into a frenzy. You know, you couldn't have got a more positive manager. And I thought to myself that day, they're going to do this. They're going to win this final. And sure enough, I was trackside reporter. I always remember it. I was trackside reporter for radio. Hazel Irvin was trackside reporter for telly. And, you know, you watch the game unfold, and you try to be as professional as you can. United fan, we know that. You know, people know the script. Richard Gordon's a Dons man. I'm a United man. But you try as best you can. I'd like to think you achieve it, of being kind of a professional, objective, but on the rest of it. Difficult to say that, you know, watching the team you supported, because, I mean, I'm thinking back to 74 when I'd seen them against against Celtic, and United went through, and we were on that old Stourie Rangers end at Hampden. We stir up your nose and all the rest of it, and United took about 2,500-3,000 supporters to that game. You know, it was different times, and that was a big away support for United. That was about as much as we could muster. And we're a decent United side, but you're up against, I think Doug Leash played in that team, you know. And
Celtic were still at their pomp,
you know. So 3-0, and probably could have been more. But you know, fast forward all these years, and here's United winning the cup, and a combo of two Dundee boys, Daly and Brewster, you know, scoring the goal. And you're walking trackside, and I always remember at the end, Richard Gordon said, "Right, Jim Spence is outside. I think he can have a word with Dundee United chairman." And I'd go on the bus to grab a word with wee Jim. I'll just tell you what language he used, but, you know, he obviously wasn't keen to do it. But fortunately for me, the mic had gone dead, the radio mic battery had gone dead just as he gave me a wee salvo, you know. So that fortunately didn't go to an air, otherwise I probably wouldn't have been here speaking to you today. But He was an incredibly passionate coach.
How would McLean have taken that? But, I mean, as a Dundee United chairman, he would have been happy. But at the same time, did you think there'd have been any sort of envy?
Traditionally, you know, I think some people have viewed it that, you know, that he was a wee bit peeved. Here's Ivan come in, you know.
And remember,
we got relegated under him next. I mean, Ivan was a force of nature. He was fabulous to deal with from a media point of view. He was fantastic, you know. was he a coach? You know, as good as Jim McLean? No, I mean, McLean was a coach par excellence, but we fell at the final hurdle so many times under him, you know. That was a problem, you know. But that said, you know, he was so much responsible for the rebirth of the modern Dundee, or the birth of the modern Dundee United, and he won the league. And he won two league cups, you know.
I'm sure I read somewhere 22 offers to leave Tannery. Now that ranges from, I think, Hearts, who were struggling really bad.
Well, the big one was down here, the Rangers. I mean, the big one was.
But what I mean is, I think Hearts tried three or four times, they couldn't get them. And then you've got Rangers, and then there's umpteen English clubs, and there's a rumour that Aberdeen sort of sounded them out when Fergie went down to Man United. So it says a lot for his loyalty.
Well, he was very settled up, and he lived in Broughty Ferry in Dundee, and he was very, very settled, you know. And he also, he had, I think what he had at Tannadice, which he probably wouldn't have had anywhere else, was he had absolute run of the place. Jim made all the decisions. Mm. The board of directors basically were there to rubber stamp them. You know, so he decided on signing policies, he decided on wages, decided on bonuses, decided on fines, you know, such as the one when he hammered the boys for not entertaining sufficiently when they put 7 past Motherwell, you know. I thought he either fined them or did he give them their entertainment bonus, I can't remember which it was. But he had complete and utter run of the place. I wonder, you know, I sometimes wonder, I mean, he doesn't keep well these days, very sadly, so it's now impossible to ask him. I sometimes wonder how confident Jim was in himself as an individual. I sometimes wonder if there's a wee kind of inverted streak where he wasn't. I mean, anybody seen him would have thought he was incredibly confident, you know. He was an incredibly passionate man, deep down, just how confident he actually was.
Do you always get the feeling that Ferguson was a wee bit more gallus? And maybe the Glaswegian term?
Fergie was govern man, wasn't he? Jim was out near Ashgill, I think, wasn't it, that area, near Lark Hall, you know. So probably in these days, more a kind of country type atmosphere. Fergie was a guy that had kind of, I mean, you know, I know all the stuff about the governorship, but actually it wasn't. I think it was a steward in one of the
Hallingdon,
you know. So, but very much,
he would have you believe he was a red Clydesdale.
But very much a product, very much a product of his environment, the Clyde, and kind of right in your face, and the environment that most city people are. You've got to kind of roll with the punches and all the rest of it. And I think in that respect, Fergie, plus Aberdeen being that wee bit further geographical, only having the one team, Fergie had everybody fired up about this West Coast agenda and all the rest of it, you know.
Siege mentality.
Siege mentality. That was never quite the situation at Tannadice, you know. But man for man, you know, I'll leave the argument to others as to how good United were. He produced several great United sides, as we saw over the piece. I mean, for a club like United to go to the city, I mean, we would have met Liverpool that year, I mean, for a dodgy referee, you know, but there's my bitterness coming out, you know. Dundee fan phoned the other day to tell me that I was one of the more intelligent men in Radio Scotland, but I was bitter and twisted, you know. I'll tell you once we're off here as to why he said that, and there's probably no for on here. But
I remember the second leg was live on BBC, but it was an afternoon kickoff.
It was an afternoon kickoff.
And I remember I just started, it wasn't only started, I was in the late teens, and the highlights were.
We blew it, we were two up for the first leg. Ralph Mullen had a chance in the early minutes of the game, blasted one over the bar. Otherwise, it would have been 3-0. It would have been 3-0. There's these great pictures, well, great pictures, pretty sad pictures, that as they come off, the Roma players spitting at them and pointing at them and all the rest of it. You know what, I've got to be honest, to this day, I can't watch Roma on the TV without hoping they get humped, you know?
Well, if you mentioned Rapid Vienna, to me, or
you know the script. I mean, I was watching them against Juve the other night, and I like Juve as a club anyhow, you know. I mean, I was at school, there's a lot of second and third generation Italian boys, and one or two of their dads had chippies and things, and they were all Juve fans, you know. So I like Juve anyway, but the other night, I was really hoping that Juve would kind of stick it to them,
they were desperate to get the final. It's worth pointing out that the final was in their home ground.
Well, that's right.
They would always be desperate to get to the final. But I mean, how many occasions does a team play a European Cup semi-final, and the prize is a game at your end pitch?
Which you would be expected to win, you know. But I mean, that he took us there anyhow. He took us to the UEFA Cup final against Gothenburg, which is a great night in the city as well.
I mean, the funny thing about the Gothenburg one is, if you don't mind me saying so, is that was in 87. If that game had been played any time between 82 and 85, then United were thumped in.
They were actually a part-time side. They were that kind of classic kind of Scandinavian side where guys
worked as
they're all about 6'1, 6'2, 6'3, you know. They were all very athletic, you know, and supple and flexible. I always think this way, and it's one of the reasons I quite like Dyla's approach to fitness. We always talk in this country about guys being athletes, and what we really mean is they're 6'2 and they can run all day. But on the continent, there were always guys that were flexible, they were supple, almost like Wee McLean getting told, bring in a ballet coach, you know. I mean, that sounds ridiculous, but guys like Lev Yashin or us went to ballet because it's, you know, it's tremendous for core, middle core strength, suppleness, flexibility, all that kind of stuff, you know. You know, I mean, what McLean did was fantastic. You know, UEFA Cup final, semi-final of European Cup, quite phenomenal for United, you know, to achieve.
The first time I remember United coming to the fore in my eyes was a semi-final at Parkhead. It was the days of the League Cup was in two legs. and we drew one each. We United at Tannadice, and we got them back to Parkhead, and we thought, well, you know, it's, we're the favourites. And the leather does that, mate. 3-0. Absolutely, it's one of the best performances I've ever seen from a away team at Celtic Park. On the look at 3-0, looks like a goon, and it was a goon, you know. But that was the first time that I remember actually opening my eyes up and thinking, good grief, you know, this is an exceptional team.
If you think back to it, I mean, it was not only was McLean very forward thinking, he was actually prepared to splash the cash. I mean, he signed, you know, in the one season, he signed Willie Pettigrew for £100,000, and he signed him in Bannon for £165,000, which at that time, was a Scottish record. I mean, it was a fortune in Scottish terms at that time. It's a lot of money. And I mean, Eamon Bannon had gone to Chelsea, he'd been at Hearts, I think, hadn't he? He'd gone to Chelsea. And you know,
Chelsea were having hard times.
They were having hard times. You know,
they're
struggling.
Not the Chelsea
nothing like. I mean, they're regularly playing to 14,000-15,000. You know, I mean, most impact in that old shed end in there. You know, but I mean, that was a lot of money to splash it. And at the time, a lot of people in Dundee were thinking, "What's he doing here?" You know, because Bannon wasn't an established player by any manner of means. But what a signing he was! What a signing.
He was a great player.
And he had that. You know, he had that kind of side. You're talking about that game. But I mean, United were set up quite often to be a classic counter attack side. I mean, Sturrock and Bannon, with the kind of pace they had, and over the years, there's the interchange. People like Millen, I mean, they were always a side that had really, really quick, pacey players about them, you know. And of course, you had that bedrock over the years in Neary and Hegarty. I mean, you used to think Neary, Hegarty, and Bannon, it was like a firm of Dublin solicitors, you know. But
it shows you what a good coach he was, for the point of view that Hegarty was an average centre forward, right?
Signed from Hamilton for £40,000.
So he wasn't pulling up any threes at the time. So the next thing, he plays him at centre half, and within 12 months, he's in the Scotland team. Again, it's an indication of how
he could spot things. He could see things, you know. And he was, I mean, he was tactically, you know. You talk to guys, you know, about his tactical nous, and you know, I mean, I've never heard anybody saying other than he was a tactical genius. You know, he would spot things that the average guy didn't. I mean, you know yourself, there are a lot of managers operating at every level that just don't see things happening. You know, they don't see things on the park, or they're not sure how to change it, or they're going to spot something. McLean was very, very shrewd that way, very, very, very smart in terms of how he, you know, saw the game.
So in all the years you've supported Dundee United, who would be the one player that you would pick that gave you the greatest pleasure?
Oh, you know, I mean, it's always difficult, isn't it? Just depend. Let me run through a few of them and I'll try and make a decision. I mean, I was saying my early hero was Jimmy Henry, but my all time hero was probably Hamish, the goalie, you know, Hamish McAlpine. I loved Hamish. I mean,
he was a character.
He was a massive character in Dundee, you know. He was a great golfer, he was a great cricketer, he was a local boy. He came from kind of just down the road in Invergarry. In fact, he just lives up a couple of miles up the road from me now. He's retired, you know, he was a sales rep for years in Dundee, but he's now, he does the kind of hospitality at the club on a Saturday night. He's a club ambassador. So Hamish was just, I mean, you remember yourself, you probably remember the banter he used to have with fans and all the rest of it. He took the penalties, you know, a goalkeeper took penalties, stuff like that. You know, he was larger than life. He could throw a ball forever. He was actually frustrated
at
field. No, he wasn't.
He wasn't.
And of course, he played for the Celtic.
He did.
A wee spell.
In the centenary season, he had a few friendly games with an emergency.
That's right.
I always remember the famous photograph that show you in the papers now and again. He's got the hoops jersey on and the scarf on his neck, and it didn't look like something.
No, there was an utterly bizarre tale behind that. Dundee United had gone to Japan, like, on, I think it was a pre-season tour. He'd fallen out with wee Jim. The legend was that he threw a pair of boots at wee Jim, was told promptly, get yourself back to Scotland, that's you here. So he came back, which led to two things. One, he was at a contract or something like that, and I'm sure he went to Celtic, but also in between times, we went and said, I might be getting this wrong, you know, it's an age function, but we went and signed Peter Minetti, who was working as a postman up in the Isle of Man.
That's right.
We went and signed him, and this of course was at a time when wee Jim had a policy, you had to stay within 5 miles of the city centre of Dundee radius, you know. So he broke it for I never figured out whether he brought Peter down by helicopter or not, but Peter had a horror show. He played a game against Aberdeen that was kind of, it wasn't quite Frank Haffey.
My brother-in-law was a Morton fan. He still talks about the day Andy Ritchie took a free kick. And Benetti never even moved.
He lasted three games.
So he did.
You know, Peter,
they called him the cat.
They called him the cat. Peter the cat. Oh dear. It was just, you know, three games. At least he was seen. United, a little known fact is that United once signed Charlie George after he'd left Arsenal. And he was promptly seen outside side at the back of the shed end at Tannadice waving a United scarf, and legend goes that you picked up the cheque, turned up one day, saw wee Jim in action on the coaching ground, thought, I don't fancy this, and apparently pissed off back to London, you know. I was never seen again, you know, cheque still in pocket, obviously. But, you know, but Hamish... Hamish obviously fell out with you, Jim. Had you that spell, didn't he, of course? But I mean, Hamish very much, for me, was a legend. I mentioned with Graham Payne earlier. I was brought up with Payne, so I'm biased. My wife went right through secondary school with him. I'm biased.
He had a brother, didn't he? Played for Forth.
He had a brother, Kenny Payne. 42 miles, I'm trying to remember the other one, but Kenny played, I think, at Forth for North Growth. He was a smashing wee player as well. Payne was a terrific player. We used to play, as I say, on a Sunday. Billy Gavine, who played for Arbroath at the time, Jimmy Morton, who played for St Johnson at the time. These guys all played, a lot of very good players, but Payne was on a different planet, you know. He was on kind of Saturn. He was one of the nine rings of Saturn by comparison to us. But in terms of kind of, you know, sheer quality, it would probably be a toss-up between Neary, Sturrock, and Bannon, and I would find it impossible. I'd find it impossible to split them.
Neary's a funny one, because like the old rave about Alan Hansen down in England, and the easy style he had it. And speaking as a neutral, and I don't have any preference to Hansen or Neary, I can only tell you the way I see it. Neary was far superior as a defender to Hansen. If he'd have played in England, he would have been.
Well Derby were once accused, I think, of tapping him up at an airport. United were going to a game, trying to tap him up. But big, you know, his nickname was Sash, and And didn't hear the West, some people often got confused with that. It was because he was supposedly Sacha Distel, so not as a nickname, you know. There were suggestions at the time when we Jim turned down Rangers that one of the reasons Jim had turned it down was because of their signing policy at the time, and that he'd wanted to go and take David Neary. And we don't know whether it's apocryphal tale or not. And these days, of course, that wouldn't have happened, because David had gone to St John's High School in Dundee, so that would have marked him out in those days. I mean, that was later on to change under Souness, as we know. And we don't know if that was true or not, but he was an immense player. By and large, he never seemed desperate to leave the city of Dundee. Dundee was enough for him.
Neither did Sturrock, you know what I mean?
Sturrock was a homebird as well. Sturrock was fair up the road and just outside Pitlochry. He played for a team called Grand Tully Vale, you know, just outside Pitlochry. And very much, you know, brought into Tannadice when he was about 15, something like that, you know, to train at the club. And Luggy to this day is a great McLean devotee, you know, a great kind of fan of wee Jim's. And Neary probably had a more kind of tempestuous relationship, because that wasn't Davy's style. Davy just did his own thing, you know.
Very relaxed,
you know. He's telling me, I think to this day, Davy kind of looks after the grandkids, and you know, does a bit of golf and mountain biking, and golf with Jimmy McInally. They two stay in touch, because Jimmy still stays up the road, you know. But Neary was, you know, to me, just the calmest, cutest, big defender. And I'll tell you, over 40, 50 yards, he was a flying machine as well for a centre defender. He could have played anywhere. You know, Bannon probably could have as well. So could Sturrock. So it would be a toss up between these three, I think. You know, they were very, very difficult to split.
One at the back, one in midfield, and one up front.
That's right through the spine of the team. Very difficult to split them, you know.
So, speaking to me a bit about yourself then, I read somewhere that you studied law. So how did you go for that esteemed position to...
Well, I suppose unlike a lot of journalists, I had a pretty checkered, varied career. I'm not going to go through all of it with you, because you would be here all day otherwise. But I mean, you know, when I left school, I went and worked in the Royal Liver for 6 months. I then went to what was then the GPO for a couple of years. I was one of these guys that couldn't quite settle. I was keen in journalism, but you know, my dad was a French polisher. My mum was a dinner lady. I didn't know the roots into journalism. I just wasn't sure how to get in there. So I farted about for a big chunk of my early 20s, you know, doing this, that, the next, jobs here, there and everywhere. Worked in Jersey for about 6 months, came back, got married, set up my own kind of carrier service. Spence makes sense, you know. It didn't actually make much sense, but did about 4.5-5 years of that. But was always keen on journalism, you know. And I remember one day I was up a stairwell in Lochy. The technical term is a drop-end settee. The bottom of the settee kind of dropped down to make it like a chaise longue. And I was up there with my cousin. We were lifting this big, heavy, beastie thing up the stairwell in Lochy, around a tight turn. It flew open and trapped me by the neck against the stairwell, this big, heavy swine of a settee. And I just thought, you know what, I'm not doing this until I'm 60 odds. So I went away back to do my hires again at Dundee College. Did my hires, gave myself the release as my own boss, went to a couple of night classes, did my hires again, applied to Dundee University, and I had the grades to go into a law degree. So I did a law degree, and it was then a toss-up whether to go to, you know, into practice or teaching. I was through the law degree. I was two-thirds way through the diploma in legal practice. Wasn't enjoying it. Didn't fancy being a lawyer, work day-to-day. And my brother sealed the deal for me. United met Borussia Mönchengladbach in the semi-final.
It was 87.
Across there, and I wanted to go and see it. Didn't have the money. I was married, but didn't have the money, you know. I was a kept man at the time, you know. My wife was working, I was a student. And my brother, who was a Dundee docker, said to me, I'll take you, you know. So he took me, he paid for it. We were away for about 3 days, 3 nights, 4 nights, something like that. And I just didn't go back to the diploma, you know. But I had my degree, that was the key thing. And I drifted into teaching. There was a job came up, I think, at Angus College. I started there. I did a bit between there and Perth, but quite quickly a position came up with Dundee College, and I taught at Dundee College for about 10 years. But while I was at university, I'd been involved in the student newspaper as a mature student. I was in my 20s as a mature student, but I'd also been involved in hospital radio, which was the route in. And I used to write letters to the BBC and send tapes and get the knockback after knock. It's a classic tale for any young journalist that wants to break into the game. I got umpteen knockbacks, and eventually one day got a phone call, which I actually thought was somebody taking a rise at me. I was actually the head of sport here at the time, phoning it through to say, what do you know about tennis? And right away, you know, being a Dundee boy, you know, I wouldn't say it was a wide-o, but I knew it was coming. So, I let him know that I knew everything there was to know about tennis, which wasn't strictly true, but it got me the gig at the Scottish Hardcore Tennis Championships. Heard nothing from the BBC for about another 3 months after that. And out of the blue one day, got a call with a cover of St Johnson game, and I did. And that was the start. That was 24 years ago, something like that. So that was how I got into the BBC, you know, mainly through hospital radio, which was a great proving ground. I mean, regularly, I always remember in hospital radio when Barcelona visited Tardis, it was me and a girl, Pamela, who did the commentary. And she'd written more precisely to Barcelona, saying, when Terry Venables comes to Dundee, would he do an interview with us, Tayside Hospital Radio? So we got a reply back saying, yes, Mr. Venables will do that. And you know how they train the night before a European match, they turn up and they train. So Barcelona are there and they've got the stars, Mark Hughes, Anglanica was in the team as well. And Terry Venables comes down the tunnel at Tannadice, that wee tight tunnel at Tannadice, and there's a battery of cameras and radio. There's dozens and dozens of guys there. And Venables, I mean, a lot of people think Venables is a wine boy, but this always sticks in my mind. Venables come down the tunnel. I know you're an attempt at Cockney accent, but he came down the tunnel and he went, all right, gents. He said, before we do anything, I've got a letter here from Tayside Hospital Radio. They're first. And I just thought, an absolute gentleman. And he just went right up my estimation. And he was brilliant. He was brilliant, you know. I mean, I often think the way the Scottish football club is, just about all of them, in fact, treat the media, you know. I mean, he couldn't have done enough. I mean, it was almost like when Barcelona were training at St Andrews a few years back, I actually had to stop Thierry Henry and say, I'm sorry, I've got to go. He was talking politics, he was talking current affairs, he was talking football. It was brilliant, you know. Different mentality. Well, I was stuck in my mind with Venables, you know. So hospital radio was a great proving ground. It was a fantastic proving ground.
You're quite popular. I'm going to sort of beat your drum here, because I work in an office, and needless to say, there's Celtic and Rangers fans in it, but we've got St Mirren Party at Thistle, Motherwell, and we've got an Edinburgh office as well, and we've got Hearts and Hibs fans coming in. And you know, they all speak highly of you, and not just yourself. It's because I think Richard Gordon's an Aberdeen man, and yes, you are a Dundee United man, and you don't hide it. And there's something to be learned there, because I don't care if you support Celtic or Rangers, right? But don't kid on the ear.
That's right.
And I think that's when fans get let down. When people try and say, you know, I'm objective, well, you can be objective and still support a team.
That's right.
And you can be objective and still have a certain viewpoint. And I think a lot of guys in the media can learn from you. And Cosgrove, he's a St Johnson man, Cowan's a Motherwell man. Yep. So hopefully the next breed that comes through will maybe feel a wee bit more comfortable of being what they are, rather than kidding on or something.
I think the big test will come when you've got somebody quite openly is happy to admit they're either a Celtic man or they're a Gers man. You know, I think quite openly that would be the case.
Spears,
you know,
is a Rangers man, yes, of sorts.
Yes, and you know what I mean, Spears,
there's
little point in rehashing the hassle that they've had at Ibrox. But Spears, he's written his piece, and I've got to say, I find Spearsy, an absolutely engaging, decent, honourable man. Mm-hmm. Right, now, I suppose, in the West, not in Scottish terms, me and him come from different sides of the tracks, you know. Mm-hmm. I'm a working class Catholic boy from Dundee. He's a son of a Baptist minister, you know.
Middle
class Kelvin side boy. He's a really decent man. He really is a decent man, you know.
I must admit, I can take Spears. Obviously, we're a Celtic website. What I was going to ask you was, who's the Celtic players that have made an impression on you through the years?
Oh, well, I mean, the great one is Jimmy Johnson. You know, I mean, I don't know if you're going to ask me how I kind of drifted into Fallen United or no, but I mean, I'll give you it now. I mean, as a boy, I was, as my old man used to call me, the second immaculate conception. My two sisters are 10 and 14 years older than me, and sandwiched in between is my brother Robert, who is 13 years older than me, and he's a Celtic man. I've tried to kind of figure out where the Celtic link comes from, and I think I've nailed it. My old granny was for Denison. Her and her sisters walked to Dundee in the 20s to work in the jute mills. She wasn't the Celtic link. She liked the Gers, you know. But my auntie Nanny married a Bielison man, my uncle Chick Kelly, who sadly passed away when I was about 7 or 8, you know. But my uncle Chick was a great Celtic man, and I think my old man was 37, 38 by the time I came along, and I think had probably lost a bit of interest in football. So, you know, how do you follow Celtic? How do you follow, or why do you follow Celtic or Partick or Morton or Queen of the South? There's something that takes you there, usually your dad or an uncle or something like that. Well, suppose my big early influence was my brother, you know, and as a boy, he would take me on, he was a bus convener on the Hilton branch of the Celtic, Dundee Celtic Supporters Club. So when I was 9 and 10, I would get taken to see the Celtic. I'd maybe be at Tannadice one week, sneak it under, or I'd be at Dens the next week. So, you know, I had a very kind of universal kind of approach to the game. And if I wasn't getting the big game, it was a way seen Dundee Downfield Juniors in the scheme that lived there, or Dundee St Joseph's, who were the other junior team in the area.
Dundee
Violet or something? When I was a boy, I think we had 12 junior sides in the city. We're doing about 8 or 9 now, but there's the Dundee Violet. They play just along the road to the Lochie Harp. There's still the St Joseph's are in abeyance now, but you've got the North End, Downfield, Broughty, I think East Craigie are still on the go. There's about 7 or 8 junior sides, you know.
There was a decent sized Celtic support in Dundee.
Well, there would be, because bluntly, if you look at the demographics of Dundee, it's actually no that much different for Glasgow. You know, I mean, I wouldn't for a minute suggest that, you know, your two big teams here are split on religious basis, although some people would say traditionally they were, you know, and in fact there's a very strong argument for that. But I mean, if you actually look at the pure demographics of Dundee, by the turn of the century, there were 40,000 Irish living in the city. Now that's, you know, that would have been pretty much 1 in 4 of the population. So, you know, by and large, the Catholic population in Glasgow would have been 1 in 3, and Dundee would have been 1 in 4. Now, by the nature of that Irish population, it would lend itself to the starting of Dundee Hibs.
Yeah.
And it would also mean that there was a big latent Celtic support there as well, you know. But my brother followed the Celtic, so I occasionally would get to see them. And the earliest memories were people like Jimmy Johnson, who were just fabulous players, you know. So Johnson, McNeil for his presence and bearing, and in the early days in the BBC, I worked with Billy a lot. Billy's granny is actually from Clippington Road in Dundee, which is just just up the road from Tannadice Park. Billy was just the meaning, you know, and he's no nickname Caesar for nothing. He had great dignity, great bearing, and all the rest of it. So, you know, he was a very early influence. Bizarrely, some of the Celtic players that I enjoyed as a younger man growing up aren't necessarily the ones that you would think about. I loved watching Paul Wilson. You remember Paul Wilson, who was a flying machine, you know, and wee Vic Davidson. I like Vic Davidson. Dalglish goes without saying. I mean, Dalglish was a genius par excellence. In fact, Dalglish, I think, wasn't along in the Celtic team when they won that 8-1 game that we talked about earlier on at Dens Park,
right.
You know.
That was Barry Old's swan song. Well, because he left
that's right.
A matter of weeks later. He went to Hibs for a season, but I know older guys, it's just before my time, always saying that was Bertie's sort of like that farewell. He just orchestrated the whole game
I always remember being at Lowside. Our Janny was a guy called and Bob Fraser, and Bob was a great Celtic man, you know. And I think a couple of years after, that Lisbon game emerged, and it was in colour.
Yeah.
It was in colour, and we'd never seen it before. And Bob charged other boys, it was about 300 in the school. And as I say, there's a big Celtic supporter in my school, you know. And he charged us all about five bob a head, you know, 25 pence in new money, to get into school hall to see a double header. And it was Real Madrid Eintracht and Celtic and Inter Milan, you know. And God knows where the money went, you know. And Bob used to run buses at school, and I can always remember going with a squad of boys to see Celtic and Ajax at Hampden. We went on a money bus to school 71, because that was a great deal. I went with George Donnelly, who went right through Los Angeles Academy. George is a senior criminal lawyer now in Dundee, and I always remember pre-mobile phones. It was me and a guy called John Ford, who'd gone through. We were all side boys. Ford was through the Johnnies. He was a lippy guy, you know, and he was giving the boys a bit of lip going through. It was a great rivalry between these two schools, you know. We were an academy, they were this, you know. He was giving us a bit of lip, and at the end of the night we got separated, and we went to a copper and said, look, we're lost. And he took us to Govan Hill police cells, and he said, you'll get a bed here for the night. And we're in with a big mad drunk Celtic supporter. We were only two daft Dundee 14-15 year old boys, you know. And I remember
social services,
and this was your bed for the night. But fortunately they turned the minibus around at Stirling. Somebody stopped the minibus and said, a couple of your boys have missed the bus. And they came back, and the boys in the bus were for killing us. But I always remember going through that night, and Cruyff, of course, was playing. Jeez, just magnificent, utterly magnificent, you know. But in terms of Celtic, I mean, the early players that would have made an impact on me were undoubtedly Johnson, who's just, I mean, somebody's asked me the other day who are the finest players you've ever seen in your life. I always tend to think the players that entertain me, you know, and boys like Johnson and Best, you know, were entertainers par excellence. We're for a different generation, you know. Funnily enough, I'm pretty sure I did the last ever interview with Janky Johnson. Brian McLaughlin in here went out to his house, I think he was in Uddingston at the time, and set up the telephone and all the rest of it. I did an interview with him on, I'm not sure if it was the old 90 Minutes programme or not, and he was kind of close to the end, but then we did the interview, and he was great, he was in great form, you know. But Johnson just kind of stands, as they would say, a boon de main, you know, in terms of the, you know, ball player. It was funny, my oldest boy was asking me the other night, what was he like? I said, he's incomparable, because he came from an age where the game was slower. But he had that such tight, magnificent control of a ball. You often beat a man without actually moving. You know, the ball, you talk about the ball glued to his feet.
Because you sometimes see a player, he's got something, and you think the one thing he lacks is heart. And you can coach him how to cross a ball and how to shoot, but you can't coach heart into a player.
There's a great picture that emerged this other day. I think one of the Celtic Twitter boys, I'm trying to remember, is it Celtic Collectibles or something I tweeted a picture of him getting tackled at Tannadice Park, you know.
And I
think it was, he's just a boy, he's got a shock of red hair. It was a shock of red hair. And I think it was either Jimmy Briggs or Dennis Gillespie, who were two great Dundee. Jimmy was a local Dundonian. Dennis was signed, I think, for he came from the Falkirk area. You
know,
that
was the first,
you know,
picture of him. In the hoops that we can find, I saw that one. It's great quality.
These were hardy boys, you know. But you don't know what happened next. But I mean, he was a tough wee customer, you know. Funnily enough, in later years, he pitched up at Dens Park.
Tommy
Gemmell was there for a wee spell, and he took Wee Strachan ended up in the Queen's Hotel in Dundee one afternoon on the champagne. I think that cured Strachan the drink habit forever, you know. But sadly, it didn't wee Jimmy, you know. So he was magnificent, you know. McNeil, obviously. Dalglish in later years, Larson. But you know, it was funny, you know, maybe it was because Larson used to destroy your team. I never quite felt tremendously affectionate towards him, because he was a hard man to interview. But funnily enough, just a few weeks back, I found myself watching some old footage, and he was a force of nature. As a player, he was just incredibly gifted.
Sometimes you don't appreciate that you're in the
presence of greatness.
Yes, and I don't think until he left we fully appreciated
and then he had a spell at Man United. He was good. Well, you know, it's one of these classic things in Scotland, isn't it? It's that old kind of that tendency in Scotland to downplay everything, what we call in Dundee, no bumming your ring in, you know what I mean? But you'd have been right to bum your ring in with Larson, because he was a stupendously talented football player. And the proof of the pudding is there, he was in fact good enough to play in any stage in the world, which we saw.
And he did in the World Cup finals as well. He was one World Cup final, it was 2002. And Sweden were really unlucky. I think they get beaten a golden goal or something like that. But he was in there competing with the best in the world.
He was. We were talking earlier on about athleticism, but Larson to me was actually the supreme athlete. Mm. He was he great flexibility, he great suppleness, he terrific pace. He was physically strong. He had tremendous eye. You know, the reason a lot of footballers that make great golfers as well is they've got that great coordination, hand-eye coordination, and he had that in spades. You knew it. Just touching the ball was terrific. He saw passes that other people couldn't see. The movement, you know, the wee give and go, terrific spring in his step.
It was never a
big
glancing header. It was
power. Don't get me wrong, you talked earlier on about Paul Heggarty, and Heggie would admit this himself, he was never a great striker, but you know, was transformed by Jim McLean into a fantastic central defender. And Heggarty wasn't particularly big, you know, but he was the same. He had spring in the legs, and Larson had that. They had that ability to generate
just hang.
Incredible power, and then he just hang there.
Dennis
Law, you know, they just hang there for that fraction of a second.
Eric Black was the same.
And can get the neck muscles right through the header.
That's right. Fantastic, isn't that? So, I mean, the League Cup final's approaching, which is part of the reason why we're having this
Don't remind me.
And if there is a wee sadness, it would have been a fantastic game if Mackay Stephen and Armstrong had stayed for a couple of months, if that could have worked out, because United have been decimated in that respect. So what's your hopes for the final?
Well, look, the hopes is a United man. The hopes would be you win it, you know. The fears are we'll get a real tonking, bluntly. You know, you know, you can too easily kind of reach for metaphors and say the heart's been ripped out the side, but to some extent it has. I mean, you've ripped out two incredibly creative players. You know, you've ripped out with Mackay Stephen, who can play down either flank, can go by men and deliver a great quality ball, either from, you know, on the run or from dead ball situations. Armstrong, you boys are seeing yourself the quality of the boy he's got. He's got a terrific driving force about him. He's got an energy, a tempo about his play. He's a passer. He can take men on. The other two that have gone to Celtic, obviously, Chief G's band. Chief G's a kind of, you know, quite a force himself up front when he's brought into play. So, you know, that's for a club like United, for any club I would argue, but a club like United, three incredibly key players. I think that will be insurmountable.
Well, that's even without mentioning Gold and Robertson, who are still recent departures.
So that's
half a team.
You've effectively had four. And you know, I mean, the United chairman had admitted to me in an interview the other day that he's made the wrong decision football wise, you know. Financially, you know, United fans are split. I would still say probably proportionally United fans think we should have
either. Do you think Johnny Russell burnt them a wee bit?
Well, yes. I mean, and Stephen Thompson said that the other day, that they got £800,000 for Russell, which most people thought was a steal.
It could have been double that
quite easily, and maybe had he had another year to go in that contract, he probably would have got that, you know. But look, the truth of the matter is, you know, I mean, he admitted the other day that the closest offer to the Celtic offer was Burnley, which is £500,000. I mean, that's an insult, frankly, you know. That's derogatory. I mean, you know, I think most United fans feel that if you're a Celtic fan, Peter Law's done a great bit of business. That's Peter. He's a powerful man in the Scottish game. He's an ace negotiator. I know Celtic fans might love him or hate him, but he's done a great bit of business. From a United perspective, poor bit of business. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, it has to a great extent ripped, I think, a chunk of the heart of the team. And it's a big blow for the manager, for Jackie McNamara. It's a huge blow for Jackie, you know.
Are you working on a day, or are you going as a fan?
No, you know, I've wangled the day off, and I'm going down as a fan. My wife's not going in protest at the sale of the two players. I'm going down. My youngest boy's going. He's going with his mate, and so I'll be doing it. At this stage, it looks as though I'll be going either with my mates on the bus, or I might just be doing it on my own. I don't know yet, you know. I'm kind of still in a state of shock. We used to go, but I've got the day off. I've wangled the day off. The last time I was able to do that was when we beat Ross County in the final. And you know, you're always torn in these things, because see the big games, you want to work.
Yeah.
As a fan, you want to go.
You're a professional as well.
You want to work. You want to be involved. You want to get the aftermatch stuff and all the rest of it. But you also want to. I kind of half of me wishes actually the Scottish Cup final I took the day off, because I was working that day. I was doing what we call a colour piece beforehand. Mm-hmm. You know, you're interviewing Lorraine Kelly and Colin McCready, famous St George United fans and punters outside. It's great, it's good fun, you know. And after the game, I've got the shorts drawn. I'm doing the losing manager, you know, and I ended up doing Jackie McNamara. It was one of the shortest interviews ever. It was two questions and that.
I think you remember seeing that, but I was also shocked on the day because in my eyes, United were strong favourites.
On the day,
they just didn't turn up.
Well, I mean, anyway, I think, I mean,
that was a big disappointment.
I mean, they didn't turn up, but I mean, but listen, absolutely fair play to Tommy Wright, as you saw last night. Tommy's actually, I think Tommy's a really good manager. I mean, St Johnson, you know, St Johnson got a lot of stick about a lack of crowds. I mean, Perth's a city of 42,000 people.
I know.
It's a town. You know, I mean, that's right. I mean, it's no. I mean, if you take any kind of the natural areas that you draw in, maybe Kinross just up the road and Creef and places like that, still probably drawing in about 55,000 people. I mean, so actually getting 2,500-3,000 home core, they're probably no any pro rata. They're no any worse off in Dundee United than Hearts anybody else. So it's unfair. But Tommy's actually done a great job here. You know, what do you call him beforehand? Steve Lomas set the train in motion. Tommy's done a good. And I tell you what, he's got United's number. We just can't beat them, you know. We just can't beat them, you know. They get in our faces and all the rest of it. But there's much more of them than that, you know. As you saw, I mean, the goal Rhys Swanson scored at Parkhead was a stunner. Another ex United man, of course, you know. They got away from us, but you know, the hopes would be for a United win to add to the two league cups we've got already. The fears would be, for me, it kind of looks insurmountable. You know,
I think it'll be closer again when people realise it. I don't think it'll be.
It depends. I think how. I mean, see when I look at the United back line at the moment, that's without Morris coming back in to the thing. I mean, I look at McGowan, who's been playing at centre defence. He's a cracking player, you know, the ex-Arts player. Still quite young. Paul Dixon on the left hand side, who left us to go to Huddersfield a few years back. Dixon's a smashing full back, he can bomb forward as well. Celtic were interested. Funnily enough, his old man Andy, who's a terrific guy, he was my laddie's goalkeeping coach when he was at Dens Park before, you know, when he was in his first couple of years there, when Alec Ray and Davy Farrell were the management team there, you know. You know, you kind of look at Big Foyou, who's kind of big, strong centre defender. Sean Dill, I'm a fan of Dillon's, I'm not sure whether they'll still be there next year or not. I'm a fan of Dillon's, you know, great club man. And you look at people like young Telfer in the middle, who, you know, hasn't quite sparked yet other than a couple of games. He's got all the ability in the world, the laddie that signed from Rangers. Ryan Dow up front, I think Dow's a terrific player. I think Dow needs to have more confidence in himself. I think he's a fabulous player, I really do, you know. I think he can step up to the plate to some extent.
I think the teams at the United, the way they're now, is you'll maybe have a wee 18-month hiatus until the next crop, the
next crop here, because I think what we've done so far has been astonishing. I mean, to bring Ryan Gawthorne and sell him to Sporting Lisbon for £2.2 million, potentially £3 million if you are the add-ons, but we've got 2.2.
Are you not disappointed that you didn't get more out of him, though, because he's awful young to leave, advice to him now have been like, listen son, get two seasons at least.
You know, the only thing I would say to you is, Steve, my laddie went through like a lot of kids, you know, great hopes of being a professional player, lacked a height, had a couple of years at the Shire after he left Dundee, and he was Dundee's 90s keeper at 16. The next season at 17, went to Shire for a couple of years with Jim McInally, played junior, bummed about, ended up playing striker, and now he doesn't play at all other than his mates. And you know, it's such a capricious sport, and such a hard sport, and such a brutal sport. I've got to be absolutely honest with you, I would just say, any boy, take the money. I would just say, I know that, you know, say if they were guys like you and me that would love to have played pro and all the rest of it.
Say, be fair,
isn't
just a case of taking the money?
Oh no, he's learning the trade as well.
It's a case of, he's been very courageous, because I can't think of many young boys that would be hard enough to be going to London, to a London team. But he's actually going to a foreign country, a different language, it's just not down the road.
It's intriguing, because he's going there, and at the same time that just before him, Ian Cathro went to before Valencia, he went across to Portugal to, and their name's just gone right out of my mind, the team that he went to, but it'll come back to me. So Ian Cathro had been the youth coach there, you know, who helped him through. He went to Portugal, he's now at Valencia, so you've now got young Goldie there in Sporting Lisbon. And I mean, listen, I mean, if I had my choice, I'd rather see all the great Scottish players playing in Scotland, you know. But if they've got to go somewhere, it's great to see them going to a country like Portugal, to a big club,
to see how he develops,
that's,
you know,
right.
Exactly, how good can he be?
And he's been making a couple of appearances. He's only a boy. I mean, you look at him, you think he just stepped
he's
out
very, very
7th or something like that, you know. But he's doing well. So, I mean, you know, it's great. As a United man, you think, that's great, he's done well. Andy Robertson's done well down at Hull, you know. You would much rather see them back here. You know, I mean, there's a great deal of bitterness, obviously, among United fans that GMS and Armstrong went to Celtic. No, I mean, no bitterness about Celtic.
Yeah, I know what you mean, but
you've
got to have a rival.
It's a rival, that's right, you know, before the final and all the rest of it, you know.
Your rival's stronger.
No, because actually, to be honest with you, as a rule, Celtic and United, traditionally, as two clubs, have gotten very well, you know. And I think Peter Law and Stephen Thompson tend to have quite a good relationship, apart from the fact that I would say Thompson's been well and truly shafted over this, you know. That's my view. Stephen doesn't take that view. I mean, he's disappointed at losing him for football reasons, but he's got to run the club. He's got to put the money
he
in the club.
He pays the bills.
And I mean, I've not got to do that. I've not got to put my house up for,
no,
you know. He's got legal responsibilities, and you know, that whole board of directors. And it was a board decision, you know. It wasn't a unanimous either, you know.
So that's us, Jim. That brings us to the end. I just want to thank you for giving us your time and wish you all the best for the future. Well, and I mean it when I say it, that you do the great stuff on Radio Scotland, and it's far ahead of any other radio stations in terms of the Scottish coverage.
Oh, great pleasure, Stephen. I enjoyed doing it. I hope we get too many brickbats for it, you know.
Well, best wishes, but maybe
no for Hamden. Good man. Thanks very much.
Love is in the air everywhere I look around. Love is in the air, every sight and every sound.
I hope you enjoyed podcast number 240. I'm sure you'll agree that was an excellent interview between St Anthony and Jim Spence. I know I speak for every football fan that I know when I say that Jim is one of the most respected people within the Scottish media. And I wish, and this is probably a point for producers and editors, that more people would understand that football fans have more than one brain cell. If someone is passionate enough to be writing about Scottish football every week, they're likely to have grown up as a fan of a particular football club and probably still are a fan. None of this pretended to be St Mirren fans nonsense. We can accept somebody saying that they're a fan of a team and then take their view on board. In fact, it probably gives more gravitas to that opinion if you know that they are a real fan and it comes through sometimes in their broadcasting or writing. We all know that Jim's a Dundee United fan and a proud Dundonian. And sometimes I think actually we respect his opinion better because we know where it comes from and he's a passionate football fan. So please stop with all the pretending stuff. Let's all be a bit more honest in Scottish football and have more people like Jim Spence talking about our game and less of the Diddies and the Dave King fan clubs and the like. Anyway, that's enough of my ranting and lecturing. That was a fantastic interview between St Anthony and Jim Spence. This is me, Harry Brady, saying good night. Good night.
Love is in the air when the day is nearly done. And I don't know if you're an illusion. Don't know if I see you true. But you're something that I'm. Love is in the air, everywhere I look around. Love is in the air, every sight and every sound.